Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 462.MK0819, certificate number 46480. Fermi problems.
As I was going to St. Ives, I met a man with seven wives.
You met a man with seven wives.
We haven't had a good math show in a while.
Oh, I thought you were going to say we haven't had a good math show.
We haven't had a good show in a while. People are missing the math. People are getting a little twitchy.
Which people? Oh, yeah, are they tired of talking about personalized license plates on Facebook page?
No one will ever tire of that. But there's a small group of finer minds, big bulbous Star Trek-headed people who are like, where's the four-dimensional math at, Ken? What about Cantor sets and orders of infinity?
Beep, boop, beep. I found a thing I'd never seen before on the Facebook Futurelings page where people report content. You've surely seen this because you're more internet than I.
I feel like I'd never go to that page.
Well, rightfully so, because there are people reporting.
Once again, retroactively, I've been very wise.
I mean, there are things on there that people are reporting for what seems like cause, but there are other things that people are reporting just because it offended them. And one, I think this is where I saw it. Somebody reported someone else for saying, I'm going to pause my participation in this group until the license plate mania ebbs. And somebody else was reported
that bad citizen?
Reported it as though I or you or whoever it is that manages our Facebook group would be like, yes.
This is good.
Erase.
We need 6% of our Facebook group members to be a Stasi-like surveillance squad, keeping an eye out for bad counter-revolutionary opinions. Thank you.
I mean, a lot of it is people reporting sarcasm. Like, this guy said something that seems mean to me because he sarcastically replied. Well, but anyway, yes, a math show. I mean, I feel like how many of the math shows that you've done, and they're all you.
There's
only two or three, right?
It's like three shows they're just usually about a Gedanken experiment.
There was the Hilbert Hotel. There was the other one that I couldn't even pronounce at the time.
We did Tesseracts once, didn't we?
I could pronounce Tesseracts.
We've done four-dimensional hypercubes.
Because Tesseracts are in A Wrinkle in Time.
That makes them okay.
Yeah.
And I assume many of our listeners are four-dimensional hypercubes.
We all do live in four dimensions.
The problem with a lot of math, how does math operate in your life? Do you feel like on a day-to-day basis, you have to math? Does any of your math training ever pay off?
Well, I mentioned this on a different show recently, but
Let's skip it then.
I watched a Instagram video fed to me by their algorithm.
What did the algorithm want you to see?
It wanted me to see Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I bet he's got some funny and smart things to say about the cosmos.
Well, he was intentionally not being funny, unlike normally where he's unintentionally not being funny. And he said, you know, the reason when kids ask, why do I have to learn math? I'm never going to use this math. The answer is not that you're ever going to use the math because you're not. But what learning the math does is train the mind.
And rigor.
Yes. Well,
that's what kids love to hear, rigor.
But also the it creates an elasticity in the portion of your mind that does math, because you also use that portion of your mind to do other things. And you use
learning new skills, for example.
Yeah, and just the kind of workout that math gives you. It's not just a general workout. It's actually specifically pushing your abilities
in a way that the humanities never would, because they're dead easy.
That's right. And also in
that's
ways...
that's always the implication of these STEM guys being like, yeah. which will never happen to you in an anthropology class, you morons.
Exactly. Like, oh, communications? Not actually a
good
major.
Good luck with that.
But I found that convincing. And I actually, the next time my daughter said, ugh, why do I have to algebra? I was like, listen, algebra actually helps you learn other things. And she was, if not convinced, at least briefly bamboozled by that enough that later I'll be able to say, remember.
It is at least hard to disprove.
Right.
In 20 years, some other hypothetical thing your brain has to do might be slightly easier or more intuitive. You will never know if it actually does come back to the Pythagorean theorem.
But I mean, in the course of a day, I do some simple math like the rest of us do, just sort of like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, you estimate or you do
right
transactions. But I do feel at a different level, I'm curious about nature in ways that deposit me in what would be theoretical math if I understood the math, right? This is the problem of the math. If you're a physicist, you need the math. But really, the physics you're doing isn't math.
But even in daily life, you're running up against stuff where you're like, if I had a little more,
yeah.
If I had another year of pre-calculus, I could get to the bottom of this.
Well, or, you know, geometry, but certainly I'm thinking, and the fourth dimension, right? I think about time and scale in ways that I wish I had the math to say, because I refer to like, oh, well, these problems are problems only because of the scale or the progress of time as we perceive it. If we were perceiving time as moving 10 times faster or 10 times slower, this would not be an issue. It's only an issue relative to the pace that we're perceiving it, or the scale, right? If I was 100 times bigger, this wouldn't be a problem. If I was 100 times smaller, it wouldn't be. So, and I know that I wish I had the math to confirm it, but it's really a thought experiment, not a math equation.
Big picture, I mean, it's true that when we make decisions that involve some kind of mathematical thinking, it's really not at the granular level of classroom math. It is, like you're saying, big questions of scale,
right.
Big picture thinking, orders of magnitude, possibilities.
An alternate universe comes into it all the time, and mostly as a gag, but like, look, this is only a problem because we're in this universe. And there are an infinite number of you not encountering this problem because they're talking to Zaphod Beeblebrox.
This seems more like emotional problem solving than... Is this like... So you think sometimes it's like mental health is math adjacent?
Well, to some degree, but I'm also... You know, I sit and run civilization models all the time. Like what are cities? What is... You know, what can we be doing to improve us environmentally, to improve at a civilization level?
You're a thinker. You're in your ivory tower. You're trying to save America.
That's right. I'm a public intellectual. I have all these shows. We qualify as public intellectuals, don't you think?
People who talk a lot?
Well,
sure.
I mean, there used to be people on television that sat and were like, what do? I just talk on television, and that television's gone, so here we are.
Most people probably had advanced degrees. We don't.
No.
But we shouldn't let that stop us.
Hard knocks. We have degrees in hard knocks.
I'm on the game show that's smarter than Wheel of Fortune.
There you go. And now you can say tonight. But no, I think because there are fewer people with advanced degrees who can also speak intelligently. There are a lot of people with advanced degrees, but they're all in math and computer science, and those people are barely articulate.
There's something about, I mean, you've touched a couple of times on the difference between math and like communication, humanities. Yeah. And there is something where math seems to be a little bit like ghettoized or siloed. Just as a kid, it just seemed like very nitpicky and precise in a way that just immediately struck me as boring.
Yeah.
And I know not everybody's brain works like that. And something about my neurons is less interested in a math problem than in a problem of composition.
Yeah.
You know, less interested in numbers than words, even less interested, I think, in numerals than in letters. Like something about the alphabet just has possibilities to me that mathematical symbols never will.
And yet, putting a child through elementary school, you see all the time these five kids in any class who are just like, math. That's what they see. That's what they love. That's the language they want to communicate in.
And I had to train myself to do that because, you know, you're not going to get far in any science or engineering field without the math. And I didn't like it. It didn't come naturally to me. It felt like I was making myself, as you say, kind of learn a rigor that I didn't enjoy, didn't speak to me at all. When we were in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago, got a panicky Zoom call from my high schooler with a test coming up, and I maybe had missed enough class that failure was possible in factoring polynomials.
Oh, dear.
And I was like, guess what? I was made to do this 1,000 times in the late 80s, and I can still factor the hell out of any polynomial issue. Let's do some quadratic equations. And it was tough because we were not in the same room. So Mindy's holding up a cell phone to the page so that I can write and my kid can see what I'm writing.
Did that help?
And we can go back and forth. And yeah, like we spent the next hour factoring quadratic equations.
That's fun.
And it wasn't fun, but I could still do it. And I realized it had built some rigor in me it made me think, I haven't done this since. And none of this is stuff that would have got me interested in math. Doing these little kind of precise, rigorous things where it matters very much if you get 21.6 or 21.7, one is right and one is wrong. That's what math is from the very beginning in a classroom. And it's a bummer.
Yeah.
Like that's...
But most of the time you hold your thumb up and look and you're like, meh, 27, 28.
The funny thing is that's what actual mathematicians and engineers or scientists are doing. They're doing a lot of guesstimating and estimating, and there's something about that that's exploratory and exciting and on the borders of things and requires kind of intuition and lived experience.
Yeah.
And yet that's not how anybody learns math. They're just learning, here are the rules that make the numbers do the thing.
Well, with my kid, I'm always throwing stuff at her where I say the solution to this is to estimate within a range and then do the math.
Yeah, so because
you're not trying to find something between 800 and 8. You know that 10 times this is this, and you know that now all of a sudden, you know, really fast, you're down to a minute calculation. And that makes math seem fun to me.
To me too.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's something about that that's the opposite of the precision of, did I get every digit right? This is a nightmare. The kind of thing that gives people math anxiety.
Yeah.
Did you read, I think this, maybe in the late 80s, this guy wrote a book about math illiteracy. I think he called it innumeracy, and that became the new kind of the buzzword for a while on TV news. The world is in trouble because we don't have these basic figure it out, does this answer make sense, kind of skills when it comes to math.
We stopped using slide rules. That's what happened.
That's what it was. Mm-hmm. I got my logarithm table right here, and nobody ever asks to see it.
Because your Texas Instruments calculator, if you can figure out how to use it.
But I think he was right. Like his insight, he's very snarky in the book, so it reads well, but also he comes off as kind of a dick.
Interesting.
But shockingly.
Yeah.
But it's that's kind of an unusual take for a public intellectual, although I guess Neil deGrasse Tyson's been trying it out. But his take was just that, like, actually, like, your day is full of decisions and impressions and intuitions that do require on mathematical thinking.
Yeah.
And you're just going to screw a lot of things up.
My mom and I have a game. Whenever we go from one place to another, we mark in our minds the route we took and the time elapsed and any kind of, you know, unforeseen obstacle in the way. And then we compare notes when we see each other. Like, oh, where'd you go? Oh, I went up to Northgate. Oh, what route did you take? Oh, well, I went up, you know. And, oh, really? How long did that take you? What time of day? And for a while, I actually kept a log.
Ah.
Everywhere I went, I wrote down the route I took, how long it took me, and what time of day. And then I realized that I had problems, that I was just a a nerd. And
that's a notebook that maybe only the Zodiac Killer has.
Yeah, like no one was interested, because I kept trying to bring it up. Like, oh, did you know that at this time of day, nobody was even remotely interested. And I was like, oh.
But that kind of stuff was fun before the modern wealth of data. You know, yeah. like I almost think there was more of a sense of, I'm gonna get some results here, when you couldn't look things up.
Right.
And that's a tension that we'll talk about today.
I'm going to hack this route across town. And now the stupid math programs, or the map programs.
Waze will just.
Yeah, it gives you seven different options, or often doesn't. And you have no idea. It always wants me to go on the freeway.
But figuring things out was a bigger part of life then, when you couldn't immediately get a number for everything, or a procedural, efficient, step-by-step thing for everything.
So now, which way do you break on this? Because I can see you being like, I'm efficient, even though I know the internet is bad and I should think this through. But I also could see you like, I'm a Luddite and I'm not going to rely on this crutch.
Often it's like, if this might be fun, I'm going to try to do this in my head.
Yeah.
But in general, if it's just a fact that it's just eating at me, I will immediately, or if we have a question and the conversation is going to depend on, well, like, what percentage of people do you think do go to church? Like, then I'm not going to be like, okay, we'll just say it's 1 in 3. I'll be like, look, Pew Research does this every year. Let's get the right number. Like, I'm a bit of a stickler for that.
Pew Research informed me a couple of days ago that 94% of Generation Z has a smartphone.
Did they call you to tell you this?
No. I was looking up something else, and I was like, 94. And I triple checked it.
Well, the age range of Gen Z is going to shock me. It's going to be 30-year-olds, right? Like, what's?
Well, no, what's 1997 is when it started. Okay. So almost, you know, 26-year-olds. But 94%, and the more I thought about it, now this is something I didn't look up, but I wonder, we traditionally would think, oh, the 6% are too poor to own one. But I see homeless people with smartphones. I think it's the 6% are too rich
to own one. Exactly. It's the rich hovering parents.
Yeah. That are like, helicopter moms.
His name is John Allen Paulus, the guy that wrote Innumeracy. He tells a story about how he has friends that are pedantic sticklers, you know, the people who will tell you, don't say infer when you mean imply, people who freak out about that kind of thing. And he was at a party where one of them kept doing this, and he was just rolling his eyes. And then I guess they have the news on.
What a lame party that this person even got invited.
It's 1988. You can only imagine how lame this party is.
Right.
And then the news is on, and the weatherman says something, you know, the weather report is going on. The meteorologist says, the weather's going to change for the weekend. It's not great. 50% a chance of rain on Friday, 50% chance of rain on Saturday. So there's 100% chance of rain this weekend. And I think even you and I, non-math experts, realize that's not how probabilities work. And our man here, our snarky author, is like, just starts laughing. And all these pedantic people whose pet peeves he's been putting up with all night look at him like, what?
That was a lot of alliteration there.
That was good. It was really accidental.
Nice and just sweet.
And all these people are like, what are you laughing at? He's like, well, you heard what he said, like 50% chance of rain Friday, 50%. And they're like, why is that funny? And he realized, like, this is actually an important distinction that's going to affect these people's voting, investment, business decisions at work, purchasing decisions.
And they're intelligent, educated people.
These are overeducated people who think that detail matters, and this kind of big, broad picture math stuff eludes them. And I think he's right. I think there is a lot of, we don't think about the day-to-day decision-making or even just opinion having that goes wrong because our brains are not wired to do math right. And I don't even mean higher math, like we're not able to think about Lobachevsky and geometry. I mean, like, when numbers get very big, we are flummoxed.
Do you look at this as a spectrum? Are there people for whom they're just seeing a matrix of numbers all the time, and then there are people that can't even picture a number in their head?
And who knows how much of that is actual aptitude and how much is just math anxiety, like, oh, no, numbers, not for me.
But
I think that, because for me, like, for whatever reason, I would just hate all this stuff in school, and then we'd get to probabilities, and everybody else in the math class would just hate this stuff, and I'd be like, no, like, this is real stuff. Like, this is like a poker hand, you guys. Like, do you not understand? Like, this relates to our lives, and I would love that. I think in recent years I've seen, you know, because as the world gets more complicated, the numbers you need to understand it get bigger. I feel like a lot of our public policy goes awry because we get flummoxed by the difference between big numbers, you know, like millionaires and billionaires both have a lot of money, and therefore, you know, we can kind of flatten that out in our brains as to one moneyed class. And it's true, they all do have more money than most of us, but, you know, it's very easy to show somebody an example like that's not a difference of degree. Like right. That is a difference of type. Like 1 million seconds is 11 days. 1 billion seconds is almost 32 years.
Right.
You know, and then somebody thinks, oh, wait, you're right. Like, I didn't see it when it was a million and a billion. Those were just large numbers.
But I think of this a lot in the sense that we used to, when we were growing up, $1 million was $1 million.
Like, yeah, you can't imagine that anybody in your, does anybody in my state have $1 million like a Rockefeller?
But
today it's like, who on my block probably has?
Yeah, driving around Seattle, it's like, wait, nobody in this neighborhood isn't a millionaire.
Yes, everybody has enough tech stock.
And this isn't even close to the nicest neighborhood in town. This is just a regular neighborhood with four bedroom houses. It's just two streets over from the other street that's cheap. And it's like, there are so many millionaires.
So sometimes our numerical assumptions just lag.
Oh, wait, you're a millionaire.
Well, yeah, mine is on TV. I can't really
pretend.
Your millions
are on TV?
Well, yeah, Johnny Gilbert night is like, who's cash winnings total? Like,
right.
Very quickly, I could no longer deny.
Right.
And it's the same with, you know, like, if you're stacking up $1 bills, a millionaire's stack would be 358 feet, you know.
How tall is that? That's a 30-story building.
It's a medium-sized skyscraper, whereas a billionaire's stack of $1 bills, that's 67 miles.
Wow.
So you really think these people, and those kind of examples, those real-world examples that connect it to something more visceral that the brain can do, which counting zeros is not, like that really does help you see, oh no, that's a different type of power. That person's operating on a different plane. Maybe the laws should treat them differently. Maybe the guillotines should arrive for them faster than our good-hearted quiz show millionaires.
Like Ken Jennings. They're nice people. They eat regular food.
Whatever the bad amount of money is, it's always more than you have.
Well, but Elon Musk and his $50 million bonus, whatever that was, it was just such an extraordinary conversation where you think like, okay, every one of those billions is 999 millions. So you could take 1,000 people, give them each $1 million, and that's one of those 50 that you're getting as a bonus. It seems like a lot. It seems like a really lot.
Too much, perhaps, some would say. I don't want to editorialize here.
I would say too much.
So this is not a Hilbert Hotel kind of thought experiment where it's like, can I get my brain around this? It really is like, these are important everyday things that math, the number matrix kind, cannot help you do, but
and the crazy,
a big picture guesstimation kind really can affect your brain and your thinking and your policy ideas, your decision making.
Because it does seem like if you're a capitalist and you're a capitalist apologist and you're a free marketer,
which we all are, to some degree, none of us wants to collectivize agriculture in this room.
That's not very.
Several of our Marxist listeners just got mad at me.
But there are also a lot of listeners who are like, that's money that they earned, and without it, you don't have innovation, and you don't have, you know, blah, 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 capital, blah, blah, blah.
But that's more defensible when the pile of money is not 67 miles.
That's right. When it is, let's say, a 60-story building or even a 600-story building.
Like, good job, Scrooge McDuck.
But not
job creator.
67 miles, it feels like that's a lot of monies.
So,
too many monies.
And people are not good at that kind of just thinking on the fly, like, oh, right. So to understand this issue, I kind of intuitively have to understand, you know, how bad this ecological thing is, or how bad this disparity in income or wealth is, or how bad this racial divide or class divide is. The other day, you remember when Alaska Airlines was having a hard time keeping the doors on their planes?
Let me see. Was that a while back?
It was more of a Boeing issue.
I see. Yeah, right. Yeah, you're an Alaska stan, But it's Boeing.
This is a rare day when I'm not on Alaska Airlines.
It's Boeing that we can yell at now.
So they were, you know, their 737 MAXs were
coming out of the sky.
We're having troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend tell me, I don't think I'm going to fly. I have a flight coming up and I just found out it's a 737 MAX and I don't want to put my kids on that plane. I'm going to cancel that flight.
And you said, statistically, you have a better chance of living under the ocean as a sentient clam than you do dying in an airplane.
Well, that's what you can do. Like, that is the power of math. Like I said, well, let's, you know, and it's very valid that you have that fear. And if you're somebody for whom this is not going to change that, that's fine. Feelings are feelings. But if you're somebody looking for math to help you decide what to do with that fear, I have the back of an envelope. Like, let's do this. How many 737 MAX 9s are there? And, you know, I could pull a number. You know, I'm sure it's more than 2 and it's less than 2,000. But luckily we had Google. So it turned out to be, there are 215 MAX 9s.
What? There are only 215 MAX 9s?
Well, yeah, I think that's because there's a bunch of different configuration of a 737. Yeah, this is one particular one that was having the issues.
Yeah.
So there's fewer than you think, but there's still 215 of them. And the first ones, the airline started to take delivery in 2018. So even with COVID, we've got like 5 years of flying. And I know from...
There are 11,000 737s.
Wow. So this number would get even bigger. But even if we're just worried about the MAX 9s, there's 200 of them. Took delivery in 2018. So even with COVID, they've been flying for 5 years. And as you know, if you've ever been like, why is this flight late? Let me see where my incoming flight from Cabo is. These planes fly 3 to 6 times a day.
Yeah, right.
So if you just do some quick multiplication, you realize that every MAX 9 is flying, or no, MAX 9s are flying collectively 300,000 times a year. And let's say COVID cut that back. So if there's 3 years worth of full flights, on the order of a million flights a MAX 9 has done, and we just heard about a worrying equipment failure because somebody wasn't putting that door panel replacement thing on right.
Right.
So now we have tools. You know, now we know there was one equipment failure in about a million flights. Right. And that's bad. We wish it was zero.
It's one in a million.
But it's literally one. And here are some other things that are, and it turns out your chances of dying by lightning strike are one in 250,000.
You're kidding. That many people are dying of lightning strikes?
So I did not tell the story to make you more worried about lightning.
Well, we don't have it here in the Northwest, exactly. So it's not really much of an issue.
Yeah, like I'm not going to move to Oklahoma, but...
Once in a year, you see some flashes in the sky over the ocean, and you're like, wow, look at that lightning.
What is going on over there? You never hear thunder. So this is your odds of the door, this equipment failure happening, or really any catastrophic equipment failure happening on a 737 MAX, if the last 5 years have been any indication, it's 4 times more likely you'll die of a lightning strike.
What are some other things that only have a 1 in a million likelihood?
It's true. You can kind of cherry pick to make it sound better. I mean, the thing you could say is like, here's your chance of dying in a car accident on your way to the airport.
Right.
Because that's always an order of magnitude or two more likely.
1 in 1,000 or
yeah,
something.
Like, yeah, like suddenly that's 100 times worse than something happening in the air. And I think for a lot of people, that does kind of help to be like, there are facts that will tell me what is safe versus isn't safe versus what feels safe versus what feels unsafe. And honestly, those people... I don't want to be all Vulcan about this, but those people will live longer in aggregate doing what is safe and not what has the vibes of safe.
What are the chances, what are my chances that someone will get close to me at some point in the rest of my life and not be disappointed in me?
Yeah, like there are, you know, those are numbers that are harder to find.
Harder to find.
Chances of finding true love in the next 5 years.
I think you can estimate it by just putting your thumb up and like,
past performance, no guarantee of future results, but anyway, like it reminded me of, like having that experience firsthand reminded me that this had been done before, that I had read about this before. The Italian physicist Enrico Fermi.
Wait a minute.
Was our titular physicist today.
Wow, is this a paradox of some kind?
What do you mean that we got to the title so quick?
No, just that you're describing a paradox.
No, this is associated. This is not a paradox. This is a kind of method that's associated with Enrico Fermi.
Okay.
Because I think we often imagine scientists trying to get things right to the third decimal place. And that is what you want in a Boeing engineer trying to keep the doors from flying off. But Fermi was kind of an interesting guy. Arguably the father of the atomic age in a way that even Teller and Oppenheimer were not. Because before anybody was trying to weaponize this stuff, he was the guy that realized how nuclear fission might work. And he produced a working fission reaction under the University of Chicago football stadium, where previously there had been no nuclear physics.
Hmm.
And maybe to this day, there are very, very, very little physics going on under the University of Chicago football
stadium. I wonder if they're not doing secret lizard people physics.
I think it's like actually a science site now, like it's a museum or whatever, because right. It's more historically important than anything the University of Chicago football team has ever done, whatever Division III A program that is. He was a good guy. He was funny. He was well-liked in his field. You can imagine, I guess, if you've been dealing with a lot of Germans and Austrians, how a jolly Italian would come off.
Yes.
I guess, to be fair, a lot of these Germans and Austrians were Jews fleeing Hitler, and they were probably a fun bunch.
Funner
than their Gentile Germans and Austrians back home.
Yeah, right.
But Fermi was also kind of the last guy in physics. Physics was already specialized in his era, but he was kind of the last guy who kind of did everything. Like, he had important results in particle physics, quantum physics, astrophysics, geophysics, like all this kind of, like...
He's a Bertrand Russell.
Yeah, and kind of in the last time when it was possible to do so, and because he was a one-of-a-kind genius. And when I say Fermi problems, I do not mean problems he actually faced during his life, although... There were plenty of those. Like, he had a Jewish wife in fascist Italy, which kind of explains how he ended up at the University of Chicago. He had to flee fascism in Europe. His early work with putting together an atomic pile before anybody really knew how to do it safely meant he and a lot of his guys developed more cancers than you might have suspected.
Yeah, right.
He died pretty young of stomach cancer. So that's
because they were drinking all the iodine.
That's what they were doing. They would be like, "Well, what happens if you drink this stuff?"
Yeah.
He was worried about guys like Heisenberg, who were like, "I'm just going to stay in Germany, and if I discover the secrets of the atoms during the Third Reich,
I'll just put them in a desk drawer."
No, I'll just give them to Hitler. That's what these guys were German, John. They were going to follow orders. He was very concerned when he talked to Heisenberg, and he was like, "Wait, you would develop atomic energy under Hitler's regime?" And he's like, "Hey, I'm German, buddy. What do you want me to do?"
Right. "I won't do it if it doesn't happen, but if it does..."
"Hey, if it all comes together for me and I'm in Germany..."
Yeah, right.
Third Reich, baby. He had to deal with, I guess, whatever guilt he may have felt at being part of the Manhattan Project, as some of those guys did. So there were 99 Fermi problems, but these that we're going to talk about are not one. These are different kinds of problems. He was famous in the classroom for a kind of back-of-the-envelope thought exercise, not too differently from what I was running with my friend, trying to tell him that he might not have to cancel his vacation just because of one door that wouldn't stay on one little 737.
So he was doing the math, or he just knew the math enough to do the back-of-the-envelope?
Well, the legend kind of makes it seem like anybody can do this. And I get why it's taught this way, because it's kind of a mind-opening, "Hey, buddy, try some math stuff," like the Neil deGrasse Tyson, you'll train your mind kind of thing. The classic example of a Fermi problem is something that I guess he would actually tell his students, which is, "Hey, who here knows how many piano tuners there are in the city of Chicago?" It's not an interesting question, but like the
79.
Where are you going off of? Just vibes?
Vibes.
How would you solve, like, just thinking in your head, your trained math civilization developing brain, if you had to posit how many piano tuners there are in the city of Chicago, how would you come up with a
go to the answer? Phone book.
You go up to the phone book. But let's say you don't have an Illinois phone book. Today, of course, Fermi problems have changed because it's very easy for me to bring back a result with how many piano tuners are listed in Cook County. But let's say I can't do that.
Okay.
are there other workarounds? Because often in science, there would not be. Like, I can't go to Venus, you know? I can't count this thing there's quadrillions of. Like, how do I get an answer? Do you what kinds of things would you try if you wanted to know how many piano tuners there were in Chicago?
Right. And what kind of would you?
Do you have ideas? I mean, like, I guess you could count you could estimate the number of people you know.
Well, how many pianos
are
there?
Estimate the number of people of them are piano tuners. I think that's the way people start. Like, how many pianos are in the city of Chicago?
How many people do I know if my group of friends are is representative
of piano tuning?
Or no, of representative of people that have pianos.
I see, yeah.
And then estimate how many pianos there are, and then how would you guess to get piano tuned once a year?
What do you think piano ownership is right now? Like,
lot less than piano ownership in 1950.
Absolutely. So at the time he's doing this, so what's your number for that?
Pianos?
The average person, how many people own a piano? The average, how many, what
nowadays,
percentage of people?
Yeah. 1 in 100 people has a piano.
1 in 100. But that's a number you're going to need. You're also going to need to know, like, how many Chicagoans are getting their pianos tuned.
Right. It's got to be.
Do you have a sense of how many people are in the city of Chicago?
Let's see. 10 million people in Chicago. 1 in 100 pianos.
Well, and you guys, you have to consider that not every person in Chicago is a household, right? So you've skipped you've skipped a step.
Okay, so let's say.
I did this wrong, by the way, the other day. We were trying to figure out in the outro, I think it was Somerton Man, your Australian corpse.
Yeah.
We were trying to figure out the likelihood that one of our listeners was an uncaught serial killer. And just I was kind of doing this on my head, and I was like, well, here's the number of unsolved murders, and here's the number of listeners. There's not. And people online were like, Ken screwed this up. He forgot that, you know, that's the number of unsolved murders this year, but a potential omnibus uncaught serial killer
could be 80 years old,
could have been doing uncaught murders for decades. So what you need to do is multiply that by 10 or 100 to get the right order of magnitude.
So let's say there's what, 500,000 pianos in Chicago? No. So there's 50,000 pianos in Chicago? Because that just, I mean, if it's less than 1 in 100, if it's, let's say half of those are not households.
Yeah.
But that's still a lot, and the vibe check does not say, oh, there's 500,000 pianos in.
There can't be, right? No, it just seems too many.
50,000.
But if there's like, you know, if the number of households in Chicago is on the order of a few million, and then what do you think, 1 in 100 has a piano, so you get rid of a couple zeros, and now you're down to something in the order of tens of thousands of pianos.
Yeah.
And you don't think that's crazy, right?
I wouldn't say 50,000 pianos in the greater Chicago area. Maybe then. Doesn't feel, I mean, how many people do I know that have a piano in their house? I do.
Well, the key insight in doing this kind of rough back of the envelope Fermi math, well, I guess there's two. One is, you don't care that much if it's 10,000 or 80,000. What's interesting to you is you got the order of magnitude, right?
Oh,
it's something with five digits. Like,
well, now wait, do you have an electric, any kind of keyboard in your house? You must have.
Yes, but those don't need tuners, right?
Right?
Okay. You gotta realize where we're going here.
Okay, so we're order of magnitude.
And then the other insight you're going to get to is that by stacking all these up, sometimes maybe you'll guess high. Maybe you'll think there's more people in Chicago than there are, which, by the way, you did.
There's not 10 million people. In Chicago land?
I think even in Chicago land, it's going to be more like 3 million.
What? Whoa.
I mean, Chicago land is big. I mean, it's what's in Chicago land. But with actual Chicago city limits, that's not a city that's on the grow, you know, like the New York or LA areas might have 10 million people. Chicago's going to have probably under 5, and maybe in the city limits closer to 2.
Seattle metropolitan area has 4 million people.
Okay. But the Seattle metropolitan area is Seattle, Tacoma, Everett. That's like the government's.
And Bellevue, right?
Oh, yeah. Plus all the east side.
Right.
Chicago metro area. Should we cheat a little?
Because
in Fermi's day, he's just kind of off the top of his head.
City of Chicago.
Chicago metro area, 10 million. So if you're doing all of that, you're fine. Chicago city population, I think, is under 3. Let me see.
Seattle city population is like 700,000.
Yeah, it's around half a million, I think. So, but let's say, so we've got a few tens of thousands of pianos. How often are they getting tuned on average?
Not very often. Every 5 years.
You think it's something like that?
I don't even think that much. Most people don't tune them at all.
Right, but some of them are going to be owned by institutions that are aggressively tuning them.
Yeah, let's say once every 7 years. It's a five-figure number of pianos tuned once every 7 years.
And then you got to figure out how many pianos can each tuner do in a year to sustain a living. You know, let's say he's working pretty full-time tuning pianos. How many can he do in a day?
Three in a day.
Let's say he does three in a day, so that means he does 15 a week. You know, he'll take a couple weeks off, and also you want these numbers to be workable, so 50 weeks a year, 50 times, what did you came up with, 15? And so that's 750 pianos in a year, and you think there's 15,000 pianos, but what do you think, there's a few tens of that? What did you come up with?
Well, I said 50, but I felt like that was too many, so let's say 20,000.
It could be 50,000. I don't know.
Out of 10 million. Yeah, maybe.
So if they're getting done once a year, then it's just 50,000 divided by 750. And we could say 1,000 if we want to make it easy. 50 piano tuners.
Is that what it comes to?
That's what it would be. So I think the actual, you know, in the actual, if you're actually looking at, you know, kind of how Fermi would have his students do this. Oh, and I think, I don't know if I finished saying this, your errors will tend to cancel out. I think I did say that, right? If you guess too high on one term, you might be too low on the other. And I think that math gives you about, it's somewhere around 100 piano tuners, I think. And that's the right answer.
Is it?
Yeah.
Then they went and looked it up and they were like, oh, the math checks out.
Right. And so this is a thing where at first it seems crazy. Like, how would on earth would I know how many piano tuners there are in the city of Chicago? And basically just your intuition about how many people there are in Chicago, how likely they are to have a piano, how likely they tune it, how much a piano tuner works. It doesn't matter if you're sure the way it normally would in grade school math. As long as you're close, the errors will kind of cancel out. And you can... You know, there are some things you can do. For example, if you need to know how many companies in the world make windshield wipers, or how many complaints the Bureau of Indian Affairs gets in a month, you know, maybe you don't know if that is 20 or 2,000. But what you do, if you given that, what you do not do is pick a number arithmetically in between 20 and 2,000. You don't right. think, well, the average would be 1,000 between 20 and 2,000, so we'll do that. You kind of want a geometric mean where, well, 20 is two digits and 2,000 is four digits. So if I'm not sure, maybe the middle number is 200. You know, you're kind of doing a logarithmic scale.
Did this get turned into an engine that's used by statisticians and polling people and so forth?
I think there are estimation tools that are similar to this, but you know, it doesn't really get associated with a lot of people. Even among his peers, he was kind of famous for this. The funny thing is today, this idea has mostly been co-opted by big business as a job interview tool.
Oh, no.
If you ask the internet about Fermi questions, what you're going to find out is that Morgan Stanley hiring, you know, seeing if they want to hire you as a quant, or Google seeing if they want to hire you as an engineer, what they're going to do is get you in a room and be like, how many drops of, you know, how many bathtubs full of water evaporate from the Mediterranean in a summer? Go.
This sucks.
Or how much does the Empire State Building weigh? Nah. How many golf balls could you fit inside the Fifth Fleet? And you are bummed by that. You were not bummed by the piano tuners.
No, but I just, because that was a fun, you know, like classroom exercise. This is just something that all these people ought to be slapped with a fish.
Well,
you remember when this was new and all the rage, like, oh, if you want to get a job at Google, they're going to say how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and you're going to show off your math stuff. And I was just like, lame.
Well, you can see why they would want to watch somebody's mind work, because this is maybe it's a good stand-in for fluid intelligence. Like, I gave you a new problem, and it's not just like the kind of thing where you can't cover, you know, in an interview where somebody is like, hey, you've been given a new challenge at work, tell me the three things you try. Like,
yeah,
Like the, but this is, you can actually
watch. But they're just computer programmers. They should be learning it at a trade school. I mean, you could learn the whole science on a train trip across the United States. Why do they all have to be geniuses?
Well, if you're Google, you can afford to cherry pick the geniuses.
Yeah, but do they have ethics? No. Geniuses famously don't have ethics. Geniuses are all criminals. That's part of being a genius.
Maybe at the end they should give you a void conf.
Yeah, that's
right. In addition to... But like it's if you're trying to see like, is this guy a smarty pants or does this guy just have a degree but he's not a smarty pants? Because, you know, obviously if you have the choice, if you're Google, you have the choice.
Yeah.
And
but this is testing for a certain kind of smarty pants. Can this person work well with others? Can this person, I mean, test doesn't test any of that.
It fails for a lot of that. But at least at first you can watch somebody and you can tell something about their person. Like, what if they keep bugging you about the question?
Yeah.
When you say how many bathtubs, like, is it like a big one, like a jetted one like my parents have?
No, I hate that guy already.
Like, exactly. Like, and a manager will be like, oh, not this kind of guy, asking too many questions about the problem.
I mean, well, I guess the interview has other components, so they're not hiring you just on this.
It's not a glowing sphere that's like zapping your brain to like ask you like, how many hydrogen molecules there might be in a thunderstorm, you know? But
but if you immediately take out a pencil and lean down, put your nose like an inch from the paper and are like...
But like, I wonder if enthusiasm counts for anything. Like, oh, hey, well, the term I do know is the Empire State Building has about 100 floors. So let me start there. Okay, like, how do I know what concrete weighs? Like, it's probably denser than firewood. How much firewood can I carry? Like, it might be kind of illuminating to watch somebody try to tackle this. Where do they start?
If they have personality, if they solve problems out loud verbally.
And there is real world, you do have some sense of how this person operates in the world. Because if they're just like, how am I supposed to know what steel weighs? But if they're like, well, it's got to be denser than wood. Let me see. Here's a barbell. I know I can pick up a, you know, when I do curls at the gym, I use a 30-pound barbell. You know, like,
right.
You can watch somebody kind of be a person, even though they're doing math. The problem is now everybody knows this is what the test is going to be. And so the internet is full of people being like, give me a Fermi problem. Like, what's Amazon going to ask me? Like, you know, how am I supposed to know, like, do I have to know the gravitational constant or...
Such a difference from my age where people were like, does anybody have any clean urine?
I think it's also a different set of jobs. It might be a slightly different set of jobs. The famous story of Fermi doing this is actually very revealing because this is very empowering to see kind of, this is some kind of math that anybody can do.
Right.
Insolvable problems become easy if you just have a little confidence and realize that you can, it's okay to be wrong and take a big picture view.
I mean, you have to keep the numbers in your head as you do it, unless you're writing them down.
Yeah, if you gotta, I think the idea is it's okay to have the back of an envelope, just to kind of keep track of your terms as you go. But the famous story about Fermi is, well, I mean, first of all, it turns out he wasn't quite thinking the way we do. Like, he was good at this kind of, I was about to do an Italian accent. Is that offensive?
No, like, no, I think you should.
You know, we can estimate this, you know, like everybody else is getting hung up on a blackboard and he's like, no, I tell you right now, it's 8,000 or 6,000, I'm not sure.
Mozzarella.
And that was because he had actually put in a lot of work. That his colleague Murray Gell-Mann said that Fermi actually did carry with him a book of formulas.
Oh, like, that he had written or just a book that
that he was accumulating. Like, how fast is water going to evaporate? Like, how does surface area vary with this? Or like, how fast do things heat up if temperature changes this much? Or, you know, and this is the kind of
building a reference.
Yeah. So you and I might be like, well, let me imagine a campfire and see, or like, let me imagine a car moving that speed. This guy actually had a notebook. This guy's cheating.
Yeah.
He had a notebook full of formulae. You know, he's not cheating. Like, he also has a very advanced mind that can look at these terms and look at these equations and understand them. But the famous story about Fermi using a Fermi problem is kind of a myth, in fact. At the Trinity test, famously, nobody knew how big a bomb this was going to be.
Oh, right.
Right?
It could be infinite bomb.
And there was some, like, we don't think it'll set the atmosphere on fire. But it's hard to disprove. Nobody's ever done this before. Like, So these are guys who are not sure what they have built. And the first estimate of the power of the atomic of the Manhattan Project comes from Enrico Fermi, who, from his observation point, holds up some small pieces, rips up a piece of paper, holds up some small pieces of paper, and as the shockwave nears, drops them.
At the actual test,
yeah,
he does this.
Yeah, he's in the desert. Holds them up and drops them as the shockwave passes, and then measures. Okay, these pieces of paper have traveled, you know, I dropped them from a 6 feet height, and they traveled about 2.5 meters, because he does see the shockwave move them. And he's got his little notebook, and within a few minutes, he's like, it's a 10 kiloton bomb.
Whoa.
And the scientists are like, why don't you slow your roll there, Fermi? Like, we've got a team for this. And the team plugs away, and they come back with 18.6 kilotons. That, based on their actual, all the instrumentation they have and their actual formulae, 18.6 kilotons. And, you know, we might be like, that moron was off by 9 kilotons. But no, that's a win.
Right. It could have been 100. It could have been 1.
Yeah. And he's got the right order of magnitude. He is extremely close. I think today maybe estimates are a little different. I think we now know that it was more like a 25 kiloton bomb that went off at Trinity.
Oh, so he
plus
is
or
an
minus
idiot.
Two. This guy sucks. Send his ass back to Italy. No, but that's, again, that's right. He thought it was 10 and it was 20. That's, I guess in math they say, what's the term? Like, to within cosmological accuracy. Mm-hmm. Again, mm-hmm. If you're engineering an airplane or an atomic bomb, you need to be right much better than within cosmological accuracy. But for a lot of math problems, what we need to know is this thing going to happen every 10 years or every 10,000 years?
Right. Will it fit in a bread box?
Yeah. Like, is this, will it take 10,000 years to get there, or will it take 10 years to get there? You know, these are big distances and big ideas we're dealing with. So the idea is that Fermi just held up the, and I kept thinking like, what on earth, what is he doing in his head? This is not piano tuners in Chicago. How is he, the papers move 2.5 meters. How is that even happening? So I dug into this. And it turns out Fermi had a lot of tools you and I would not have in that situation. For one thing, he had been going to lectures about shock hydrodynamics at Los Alamos for the last 9 months. Like five different physicists had been giving lectures about the dynamics of blast waves.
Right.
And one of them, the physicist Hans Bethe, had even given four equations that allow for acoustical modeling of what a weak shock wave does. So again, you and I do not have access to all this previous art of how shock waves propagate.
We also don't have access to an atomic bomb explosion.
So no one is likely to ask. I have small pieces of paper.
Yes.
I'm halfway there. Of the two things I need to do this,
right?
Small pieces of paper and an atom bomb.
Yeah.
I'm halfway there.
I've been to the desert.
Have you been to this desert? I've never been to Alamogordo. Have you ever been to Los Alamos?
I've been to Los Alamos, yeah, a few times, but I've never been out to the Trinity site.
I assume there's stuff to see today at the site.
Yeah, and I think, well, I heard somewhere that it's only open very infrequently.
Huh.
And going is like a big, cool deal.
Like nerds have to plan. It's like an eclipse. You got to figure out which weekends you can go.
I feel like it is.
So anyway, the reason why Fermi can do this is because he has been jotting down all the series of equations, and they're very technical. Like, apparently the equation that's important here relates the energy of a blast wave to things like your distance, the thickness of the wavelength, the pressure, the speed of sound. E equals 2/3 times quantity 2 pi distance squared over 3 rho sub 1 times C sub 1, speed of sound squared, all times the quantity delta P, that's the change in pressure, squared times L, the thickness of the wavelength. So this is very different than even a Google, how many bars of chocolate would you have to eat to heat every house in your town, or, you know, these right. kind of things.
You're like, not going to have that equation on hand.
Yeah, nobody has this kind of knowledge on hand, and it would even be difficult to, how are you going to do the orders of magnitude if you don't know which terms have which exponents and blah, blah, blah? And it's very, most people believe that the way he did this is because he took these equations and in advance, he knew the strength of various shockwaves because, in fact, he already had a list of pressures, blast wave pressures from different TNT explosions. So he also had data that you and I could probably not even Google, which is, what's the pressure change of this many tons of TNT? What's the pressure change of this many tons?
Right, I see.
And so he had probably pre-prepared a table saying, if the papers move this much, here's the yield.
Right, he'd thought it out. So, but did this actually happen? Did he really do this?
Did actually happen.
Oh.
So the myth is not that he didn't do it. He did the paper thing. He had the first estimate. But it was because homeboy already had a notebook that said, if the paper moves 6 inches, it's a kiloton yield. If they move a foot, it's, you know, so he already had this all ready to go.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me that kind of limits the idea of what a Fermi problem actually is. Like, to do anything interesting on the level of invent a new weapon system or, you know, to do any kind of groundbreaking work, you can't just be doing piano tuner counting.
Right.
But the good news is most of us are not trying to develop the atomic bomb. We're just trying to figure out what is the right policy to deal with growing wealth inequality, or what is the likelihood that I will, you know, that I should go on this airplane, or, you know, in these kinds of situations. A little multiplication on a napkin really goes a long way, I think.
A little multiplication on a napkin. That feels like a sex euphemism.
It does? To me in no way. Oh, I guess I see what you're saying. Multiplication.
On a napkin. No, I don't mean multiplication.
Like they're multiplying.
No, like I don't mean chills? It that way. I just mean like the activity.
Multiplication on a napkin.
It seems busy and also confined.
What kind of band would have a record called Multiplication on a Napkin? It's going to be like New Order or something, right?
Oh, that or I was going to say like the Aquabats.
Oh, right. Goofy nerd rock. No, we didn't have that when I was a kid. So I guess the takeaway from all this is pretty lame because it's just me saying math is fun. I'm basically Neil deGrasse Tyson at this point.
Yeah, but I do feel like this is the kind of way of thinking of math that I guess contextualizes the kind of math we're already doing and expands it to make it feel like maybe real math. I mean, I in my own life, I took high school physics and it was the worst class I ever had. And then I took college physics and it was the best class I ever took.
Why? Because you could do...
Because the teacher didn't dick around with being precise and instead spent a lot of time standing up, sprinkling pieces of paper through the air and going, look, like, watch what happens when I do this. And it was very experiential and it was very engaging. And I came out of that class feeling like I want to be a physicist. It's the most captivating thing I've ever taken, including, you know, much more interesting than government and English even. And then I looked at the course requirements and it was like, well, good luck on your 7 math classes. And I was like, oh man, that's not, I mean, I want to just jump right into.
You want to make bombs and they're trying to make you do differential equations.
Well, yeah. I'm like, let's travel to the stars. And they're like, nope. Algebra 2.
I think it must work because I've noticed looking at my kids' math curricula, they are nothing like mine when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we did get some, okay, get an answer and then maybe try some rounding and see if you still get the same answer. Like, I guess we had that. But yeah. Like kids today, like a lot of math starts with, picture this pile of 8 things. Now picture this pile of 60 things. Like, are you close? You know, they're doing a lot of like, can you conceptualize a quantity? Can you conceptualize a change to a quantity? Like, can you conceptualize a real world illustration of a quantity in ways that we never did? And I have no idea if it's working. I mean, even if kids are getting dumber, maybe this is slowing down the kids getting dumber at least.
I mean, do they still give you a piece of mimeographed paper with 100 equations that are almost identical except for, you know,
isn't that what it was?
Three numbers change
around?
You
get a blue dittoed grid and it was like, and each one would be the same. It'd be like, do 6 times 5, do 6 times 4, do 5 times 4, do 5 times 4, do 6 times 4 again. Like, and this would be, it would be five rows of those, six columns of those, and it would just make you want to shoot yourself in the head.
Yeah, and then when you get to algebra, it's like x plus 4 equals y times 2. X plus 4 equals y times...
Factor all these very similar polynomials.
No, I won't, is what I said.
So maybe this stuff is better, you know? I think whether it gets you a job at Morgan Stanley or not, I think that is how kids are learning, and I hope it helps.
Well, I feel like the kids that want to solve differential equations are going to find that path, right? There's no...
Yeah.
What we don't have in schools right now is like, oh, this person really should be a dancer, or this person really should be a poet and not... But we don't have to struggle to find a place for the math kids because... It exists already.
I think the idea is that even the dancers and poets are going to have to do a budget.
Yeah.
Or have a sense of whether this batter should lead off or that batter should lead off.
And
or,
it makes more sense to teach math the way you're describing, where it's like, what?
It's vibes, basically.
Yeah. Why is it even called math? We should call it just vibes. What if there number vibes.
What if there weren't numbers? What if, like, this the big numbers were red and little numbers were purple? Like, I almost think...
Yeah,
I almost think there are ways of doing it that like that take the idea that you need to get a correct result out of the equation.
I've told you that as I traveled across, I don't know if I've ever told you about walking across Europe, but as I traveled east and there was less and less precision in the street signage, you know, if you ask somebody in Germany, how far to the next village? They'll say 3.7 kilometers. But if you ask somebody in Romania, how far to the next village? They have none of that sense, or at least, you know, 20 years ago, they were like, 10 kilometers. And I would say,
nope.
No, it's not. It's like 3 kilometers. And they would say, well, if you know, why are you asking me? And I would say, well, I just figured you would know.
You were doing a prank show, an Eastern European prank show.
Yeah, they're like, how many people are going to be at the festival? 1 million people. Well, I know there's not 1 million people. Oh, well. Why are you asking me that? 500,000? I mean, I don't know, 10,000? And just realizing like the sense of numbers was very much like, I know how many tomatoes are in a basket, but if...
It's like these pre-contact cultures that have like one, two, and many.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah. I don't mean to suggest that Romania isn't a modern country, but particularly...
But someday they will be.
Out in the sticks where you're dealing with... You know, people that have not really left the village.
I mean, the answer to them might be 20 minutes by donkey, you know, or like, you know, less than an hour. Like, you know, they would know that.
And like how many tomatoes? Kilometers. Like how many tomatoes? It's like the number of tomatoes in the village is the most tomatoes they ever had to think about.
The best chefs you've ever seen are probably not
measuring 0.8 grams
or whatever. They know exactly what sprinkle of corn starch they put in last time.
But that feels like vibes that math colonized after the fact, right? Like, true. I'm a dick, so I'm going to tell you how many ounces are in that. But nobody for 100,000 years.
But you wind up with these sciencey Alton Brown guys who will tell you this is the secret. Let's make sure we measure everything exactly right. You don't want too much flour. And like so many other things in life, I think we're seeing that actually Fermi works better. It makes you feel less bad about yourself and your answers are going to be good enough for most of the daily things you need them for.
You know, I know a guy who knows Alton Brown, and he says that he's some kind of weird QAnon crackpot.
This is now going to be the end of the show, by the way. Like, this show
will... The end of the show permanently, you mean? Alton Brown's going to sue us to death?
No, this is it. Like, we talked about math for an hour, and then the last thing we're going to say is that Alton Brown believes in QAnon. This is the finding we got to. From now on, this is going to be part of the outro. We wish you many goods and cheese. Alton Brown believes in QAnon.
And that concludes Fermi Problems, entry 462.MK0819, certificate number 46480 in the omnibus. Futurelings, let's leave social media out of this conversation. For the love of God, I don't want to be fed any more content.
This is an order of magnitude problem.
Yeah.
How much social media should you look at? Near zero.
Near zero, and yet how much do I look at? 100.
Is that the most?
And I don't like
it. Is that the most social media there is? 100
is the most.
I feel like you need some Fermi training.
I do not have 100 social media because other people have way more social media than I do. but I have too much. Yeah, that's vibes. How much is too much? Too much is too much.
I would measure in hours. And that's hours. Actually, that's what I like when my phone
says, you've spent 8 hours dicking around.
Here's what you wasted per day this week. And then I think this is actually helpful because
it's embarrassing.
It gives me shame in a way that experiencing it did not. Counting it is better than inducing shame than experiencing it.
Well, if you do go online, you should spend most of your time trying to find things that at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick have either posted or written or shown the world. But you can email us, which is a real thing. It's not social media, although it is social. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other futurelings in a very nice place called Futurelings, wherever they are. I think of it all like as a single place. Facebook, Reddit, Discord, Discourse.
It is.
It's all one.
It's the cyberverse.
Omniverse. And you can mail us actual things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. Ken, that envelope looked like it had 50 stamps on it.
Yeah, it comes from Japan. And so this is the normal number of stamps. But also, it's being from Japan, it's the normal number of like
ink stamps,
stickers and stuff. Although I think it actually came from Australia. Am I wrong? There's Japanese kawaii stuff on it. It did indeed come from Australia.
Mm-hmm. One of the great countries down there.
Wait, NT. Does that mean Northern Territory?
Yeah.
Nulunbuy.
Nulunbuy in the Northern Territories.
I didn't think there were omnibus listeners in the Northern Territory.
Oh, yeah, lots. They're up there fighting the bugs.
Debbie enjoys the show. She wanted to send you a self-portrait.
That's a strangely large piece of paper. Wait, she wanted to send me a picture of herself? Is this one of these Australian war brides things?
Well, it looks to me like, it's a beautiful piece of Japanese paper that maybe has already had some kind of a fish water ink washed onto it.
I don't think that is a self-portrait, but yeah, is this like a, like one of those Native American artworks drawn on a old ledger arts?
But let me see, is this the thing she's talking about? It's some beautifully wrapped rice paper.
Are you ripping it?
I guess.
Don't rip it.
There's no other way to get it. Oh, I think it's the wrapping paper. There's three kind of Band-Aid-like stickers that take paper with it when you rip them.
Oh, so. I see. The wrapping paper isn't the art, hopefully.
I hope not.
Or maybe this is some Japanese trick where you destroy the art to open it. What have you found?
This is a monster from the Japanese Ultraman franchise.
Oh. Are you familiar with it, being a consumer of Ultraman?
I was vaguely aware of the Shin Ultraman movie from a couple of years ago, but I did not see it. But she's helpfully sent us a catalog of different Ultraman looks, maybe?
Ultramen?
Ultramen. Lots of Ultramen at work here. Here's all the robots, and here's maybe the monsters they fight.
They are toys. Or are they just characters in media?
Probably both. Isn't that how Japan works?
I think so.
I live in Nulunbuy, I'm probably saying that wrong, in the Northern Territory, a mining town on Aboriginal land, an amazing place of beautiful beaches and rich color. You should come, culture. You should come and visit, but it is in the tropics and very hot, so I understand that you may not want to. That's fair enough, Debbie. Like, she's considered both sides.
Yeah. You should come, but on the other hand,
if you do come, it would be nice. But on the other hand, we would understand if you don't.
We have the same climate as Borneo.
Because it's very hot.
Bring a hat.
Debbie, thank you for sending us this. I guess this is a portrait of the kind of Ultraman monster she imagines herself as a futureling. And it's very nicely done. Thank you for your awesome. It kind of has, does it have Aboriginal art quality to you?
It does.
Even though it's an Ultraman.
From over here, it does.
Even though it's some kind of Ultraman kaiju. Thank you, Debbie. We also got, this is going to be somebody Amazoning us something without explanation. No, this one has an explanation.
Yay, is it a box of chocolates?
Oh,
I think Ginsu steak knives.
This is the same person last week who sent me a Paisley bookmark because she likes my ties on Jeopardy.
Oh yeah, the deep science one.
And in fact, she sent me a purple and green paisley tie. It's iridescent.
Oh. Take it out of the bag and let's see it.
It looks like the water at Love Canal.
Now, are they going to allow you to bring your own tie to the show, or do they pick all your ties?
Typically, my ties are picked out. We actually have over 200 ties now that I rotate, and a bunch of Alex's old ones, too, that I wear.
Oh, and you can wear Alex's ties?
Yeah, it's kind of fun. Occasionally, I'll wear an old Alex tie. What do we think of this? I like the width.
Well, I think it's pretty attractive tie.
It is iridescent.
What is the brand of tie?
Hisdern?
Uh-huh.
No idea.
Amazon label?
Exactly.
Oh, that's a pretty tie.
Thank you, Crystal, and matching pocket square.
Oh, pocket square.
By the way. I'm not sure I'll wear it on Jeopardy, but I will wear it when I dress up as the Joker for...
It's more subtle than a Joker tie, but I don't know that much about the Joker.
I'm thinking the Joker would wear this awful garish purple suit, but then kind of a cool, understated...
Oh, yeah, okay.
...purple and green tie.
I see that.
Like this one. Thank you for passing that along, Crystal.
Finally, I'd like to encourage you to support the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Let me use my most seductive internet voice.
This is going to do it.
To say, for only $5, I will come whisper in your ear every week on Omnibus.
What if we did an addenda show that was just you whispering?
Just like, hello. Hi, everyone.
I'm speaking to your panties.
Ken is not able to do this show this week because he's in California.
He can't do this voice.
But I'm doing the show all by myself.
You're a late night DJ.
Ken, it's Dr. Johnny Fever.
We're going to play some Barry White now.
Ken has sent me all this stuff in text message form.
Yeah, what if I just sent you my content and you just read both parts?
I'm just like, and here's Ken. And now here's me.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we had no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, however, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we remind you that Alton Brown believes in QAnon allegedly. And we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
New messages.
Hey Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.